The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Happy April Fool's Day. I'm giving you an early alert. Be aware. Someone's going to try and call you up and play a trick on you. Don't fall for it. Do not fall for it. This is your anti-April Fool's Day. I've done it a couple of times over the years, but with a major war underway in the middle of Lent, it doesn't feel like an April Fool's Day to me. I read late in the evening last night, it appears that Russia is about to suffer a strategic defeat. But great powers have often made mistakes from which they've recovered, and Russia's a historic great power. They can scramble. They can figure it out. There might be a few generals hanging from rooftops and secret agents being tossed from the Kremlin tower, but great powers commit great mistakes. Remember the Suez invasion by France and Great Britain, backed by Israel. Eisenhower just turned thumbs down, and it was done. And it caused the fall of the Anthony Eden prime ministership. But think about the U.S. in Vietnam. Think about Russia when it was the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. Think about our war in Iraq. Probably a strategic mistake in retrospect. We'll never know for sure. It's a counterfactual. Certainly, the United States made a grave strategic blunder in the capitulation and scramble and cut and run in Afghanistan by Joe Biden. And because of that, it triggered another historic mistake. And this morning, the updates are all good, but that makes me worried for Ukraine. Last night, I watched the subtitled speech by President Zelensky. Among the things he said, we know what they are planning and what they are doing, he said, of Russia. We know that they are moving away from the areas we are beating them to focus on others that are very important. And Ukraine went on the offense into Russia yesterday. For the first time, they crossed their helicopters into Russia and struck an oil depot in a Russian city. Little bit of the Doolittle raid there. Nothing like bombing Moscow, but don't rule it out. Do not rule it out. Europe has a deadline from Russia today to pay in rubles. Now, why do they want? What is that? And so I went looking for that and found the answer in the Financial Times. In retaliation for Western sanctions, Putin, in effect, aims to force the West by this buy your natural gas in rubles into breaching its own rules on sanctions by having to interact with the central bank and the banking system. It's of very little consequence. It's all about face for Vladimir Putin right now. He's lost so much face. F-A-C-E, before the Russian people. They know, they see, they understand thousands of dead Russians, conscripts, massive disaster, the expectations game. If you can imagine back to the invasion of Iraq, and Generalissimo was here at the time. Hey, Generalissimo, are you around? Is Dash here?
So one of us is.
Okay, Dash is here. Dash, if we hadn't taken Iraq, Baghdad in 3 weeks, in 2003, or if we hadn't won the Gulf War in 100 hours in 1991, can you imagine what would have happened here in the United States?
It would have been all over with. Can you imagine what George H.W. Bush would have dealt with if we didn't take over Kuwait and rescue Kuwait as quick as we did?
And so democracies are used to short conflicts. And we
decisive.
Win quickly.
Yes.
And decisive. And we win, we dominate the air, we blow them up. Russia hadn't done that. They don't even have air superiority. So now Europe is deciding and has decided they're going to send it all in. This is from the Express in the United Kingdom. The West will send Ukraine long-range artillery to counterattack Russian forces digging into pound cities. Ben Wallace, who is there, Lloyd Austin there, Donald Rumsfeld, their Secretary of Defense. He said that yesterday. More lethal aid will be given to Kyiv to fight the Kremlin's killers. We're just sending everything in the world. And the fact that two Ukrainian attack helicopters flying at low altitude can pierce the Russian territory undetected and strike an oil depot is really quite amazing, quite remarkable. Leaders from China and the EU will meet today, their first summit in 2 years. Brussels is going to lean on China to stay out of this thing. Hundreds of Syrian fighters are en route to join Russian forces in Ukraine. Now, they're going to get killed. They're just cannon fodder. Like the Chechens, they bought up to pose, and then they're going to get killed because the Ukrainians don't care that they're from Syria. Not like there's some great big, like the Wagner Group, much heard about, very little felt. And Ukraine, meanwhile, has prompted, according to the Wall Street Journal, NATO countries to raise military spending. Remember, Donald Trump was very effective in this with most of them, not Germany, but Germany is now scared and they're raising it. 29 states are gradually increasing their spending. Still, most of them are behind their 2% commitment. Donald Trump served notice and Vladimir Putin is serving need. The Wall Street Journal opines this morning, as Russia's war on Ukraine enters its sixth week, the script has flipped. Russia's advance has stalled, and Ukraine now wants to go on offense to push back Russian forces from the land they've taken. But the country needs U.S. and NATO help, and it seems that the Biden administration is reluctant to provide weapons and intelligence. In her Wednesday press briefing, White House Communications Director Kate Bedingfield said no fewer than 8 times that Putin had committed a strategic blunder or mistake or error by invading. It's the White House line to suggest that the West is winning against the Russians. But that sure sounds like a premature declaration of victory. His forces are still bombing Ukraine cities and they've grabbed more territory. Putin could still emerge with a strategic advantage in the medium to long term if he strikes a truce that leaves Russia in control of a large chunk of Ukraine. Journal is correct. The peace terms Russia is demanding suggest that such a consolidation in Ukraine's east and long-term occupation is now Russia's goal. He'll have won that long-sought land bridge between the Crimea and the Donbass. Mr. Putin could claim victory, pause for some years while he rearms, continue trying to assassinate Zelensky, otherwise make political, cyber, and other trouble for a Western-leaning Ukraine government. That's why Mr. Zelensky now wants to go on the offensive. The more territory his forces can win back, the stronger position his country will have at the bargaining table. And this is absolutely true. Absolutely true. We've got to give them everything. Other stories. Over here in the United States, there's really nothing to compare with the Ukraine story. It's the story, and Admiral Stavridis is going to make a rare Friday appearance to update us in the next hour on what's going on. But there are other stories here at home. They're negotiating a COVID relief bill in the Senate, about $10 billion. Nothing compared to the trillions and trillions. They'll get it done. President Biden has ordered the biggest release ever from our strategic reserve. This is not a good thing. It is not a good thing. This is an admission of an inability to get off the mark and drill. This is an admission of impotence in the face of the environmental left. And Jerry Hendricks tweeted out the history of the petroleum reserve. It was begun in 1975, after the embargo by OPEC in 73 and 74. At 760 million barrels, it's at max capacity. And so Trump filled it completely up, maximum capacity. It can supply the United States with energy for 29 days. That's it. It's our reserve. Joe Biden is trying to lower the price of gas at the pump for 2 days, about 2 days worth of release, maybe three. It makes no sense to do this. What makes sense is to produce and get. Go back to the Canadians and ask them to please, we've made a mistake. Let's get Keystone built. It's as strategic to the United States as a Qatari pipeline to Europe of natural gas. That's what we need. I'll also say this. Andrew and Todd.com are great sponsors of the show. AndrewandTodd.com lend you money to buy your house. And I bring it up because it's a news story in the first hour. You can call them at 888-888-1172 and borrow the money and buy the house this weekend. Mortgage rates surge to highest since 2018. This is according to the Wall Street Journal this morning. The average rate for a 30-year fixed-rate home loan jumped up to 4.67%. Mortgage giant Freddie Mac said Thursday, marking the weekly figure's highest reading since December of 2018. AndrewandTodd.com might be able to do better for you than 4.67%, but that's the average nationally. You won't know what you can get your home for until you call 888-888-1172. And I urge you this weekend, tell your son or daughter, your grandson or your granddaughter, you'll become a non-occupying co-borrower. Have them get a letter of approval, an offer letter that backs up their offers. They go shopping for a house here at the beginning of April. Get going on this April Fool's Day. Tell them it's not a joke. I really do want to help you buy a house. And then call Andrew and Todd at 888-888-1172 or go to andrewandtodd.com. Then come right back here. The Hugh Hewitt Show rolls on this April Fool's Day. Don't fall for it. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining me. Sonny Bunch is the official movie critic of the Hugh Hewitt Show. No April Fool's jokes here, Sonny. Don't tell me to go to a movie I will hate, please. Don't tell me that it's a child's film and it's really a horror film and I take the grandkids to it. None of that, right?
I would never do that, Hugh.
I don't know about that, Sonny. I just now could not persuade any of my team to go down and talk to the officer in the parking lot at our studio, who is calling me because they think I was playing an April Fool's joke on them. It's the downside of April Fool's Day.
What's going on with the security? Why are they calling?
A sketchy van parked, sort of eyeballing the team's cars. It's early in California.
Well, you know, hopefully they're still there when you get out there.
The officers were there. I'm not worried about, but my credibility on April Fool's Day is low, given my past history.
Are you a legendary prankster? Are you?
I have done a few jokes in my day, and they've been good, but this was not that. So, Sonny, what did you make of the Oscar night?
Boy, that was wild, huh?
I spent all month. I've never talked about the Oscars on a talk show for longer than 2 seconds before, and it took up the whole show.
Yeah. So there are a couple different things that I think about the show. First off, the show itself, even before Will Smith's meltdown, was kind of a mess. It was disjointed is what it was. I mean, it wasn't just that the weirdness of having the pre-taped awards kind of spliced into the rest of the show and how like awkward and stilted all that was, right? That was weird. And it was also like weirdly mean-spirited before that. Like, I don't know if you remember this, but there was there were several jokes about the people in the crowd having not watched the movies. The hosts were joking about people not watching movies, some of them which were nominated, like The Power of the Dog. Wanda Sykes made a joke about, you know, I've watched Power of the Dog 3 times now, and I'm almost halfway through it.
Ouch.
Yeah, and somebody else, Regina Hall, maybe had joked about nobody seeing The Last Duel, which wasn't actually nominated for anything. But it was a movie I liked a lot. We talked about it. I thought it was a great movie. And once upon a time, that is the sort of movie that would have won a bunch of Oscars, right? It's a historical epic. It's a big rousing action movie. It's got huge stars like Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, and up and coming stars like Jodie Comer and Adam Driver. It's directed by Ridley Scott, who, you know, has his own pedigree and has won Oscars for, again, movies like Gladiator. Instead they're joking about how nobody saw that, which is, you know, a bad thing for them to be joking about, because that is the sort of movie that Hollywood needs to be successful if, you know, theaters are going to continue to be a real thing, if, you know, the concept of the movies as a big deal in America are going to be a big thing.
So, but you saw Ross Douthat's column last week in the New York Times.
Yeah. We talked about that a little bit on Twitter, right? It's the movies, capital T, capital M, the movies. You know, if that is going to have a future, then movies like The Last Duel need to be a success just for the sake of the industry. And to joke about how, you know, nobody's going to see any of these films is bad. I mean, look, a movie like Coda is a perfectly nice little movie. is a nice indie festival schmaltzy darling, and it is pleasant and it's fine. But it's not the sort of thing that will actually make a difference in terms of, like, here is a big cultural event that is a must-see. And you know it's not a big cultural event that's a must-see because only, I think, 4% of the audience of the Oscars had seen it. There was a poll
out. It's neither Saving Private Ryan nor Shakespeare in Love. It just isn't.
Right. It just isn't. Maybe this is just a sign that the movies are changing and the culture is changing and blah, blah, blah. So even before Will Smith attacked Chris Rock, it was a weird show. The attack itself is such a stark live TV moment that it was hard to understand what was happening, in part because, you know, they dumped out the audio and they dumped out the video. I've never actually seen this. They skipped ahead in the actual video broadcast and then skipped it back a little bit and then skipped ahead again. So I was totally confused as to what was happening watching it live on TV. It wasn't until we saw the raw feed come in from Australia and Japan. You know, people have taken Twitter videos of the raw feed from Australia and Japan that we saw what happened. And, you know, Will Smith, I like Will Smith. Will Smith a lot. I think Will Smith is a great actor. And I think his Oscar was deserved. He's had a great career. I mean, legitimately one of the biggest box office draws from over a 12-year stretch. We've never seen anything like it before, from you know, 95 to 2008 or so. Just like it, just a total dominance at the box office, the likes of which we've never seen. So I like Will Smith. For him to do what he did on live TV on, you know, the movie's biggest night is relatively disgraceful. I'm going to throw this out there. I was surprised by it, and I was shocked by it. But after having read his memoir, he is going through weird mental things right now. He's in a weird mental headspace, and it was shocking to see him hit Chris Rock, but at the same time, it wasn't shocking for weird reasons, because in his book, he talks about having lived a whole life trying to please other people. And you know, anytime he's out anywhere, he signs every autograph and he takes every picture and he does every video. And, you know, he's always trying to please other people. And in his book, he talks about having to kind of deprogram himself from that to get to a place where he is comfortable saying no to people, that he is not just going along with the flow, not just trying to be the big star in the world, and instead is looking out for, you know, Will Smith's mental health, right? And you can actually see this process kind of happen on the show, because if you watch it, initially he's laughing at the joke. Then he sees that Jada Pinkett Smith is mad about the joke, and then he goes up there and decides to do something about it. Now, if you have read his memoir, again, you can see this as a situation where he is laughing because, you know, he's expected to laugh and to go along to get along and it's fine. And then realizes, I don't want to laugh at this. I don't find this funny. I don't like it when my wife's made fun of. And then decides to do something about it. Now, what he does, again, deranged, and he's going to pay a price for it. I mean, I have a hard time believing that he is allowed to remain in the, you know, in the Academy of Motion Picture Art Sciences, right? I think he's going to get kicked out, and I think he's going to be banned from the show, and I think he's going to be declared, like, never eligible for an Oscar again. Not that he would ever be nominated, no matter how good he was, because people are so, you know, upset about this. But, you know, it's bad. It's bad. And this is, you know, there's a secondary argument to be made here about, you know, this is what happens when you say that speech is violence, and this is what happens when you say that comedians shouldn't be allowed to tell certain jokes. You know, this is the end result of cancel culture, blah, blah, blah. And that's all kind of true. But I think this is just about a man who's having, like, an actual mental breakdown live in front of the rest of us.
No, that's unpleasant. Let me say this, Sonny. I don't I don't watch the Oscars. I love movies. I don't care what the Academy does. I wish them all well, but I still think Chris Rock and Will Smith will be making appearances together.
You don't think they'll be making appearances?
I do. I do. I think they will be making. I think that they will fix that up. The rapper said, who did it? Coombs came up afterwards and said, we're going to settle this in the family. They will. They'll get together. They'll have a, I don't know what the Academy does. Who cares? Who cares? Is there a movie for me to see this weekend?
Well, it depends. Do you want to see the new Marvel movie?
No.
Morbius.
Oh, no. Give me 1 minute on Morbius before we have to go to break. What do we think?
Starring Jared Leto. It's bad. If you're a person at Marvel, you cringe when you hear me describe it as a Marvel movie, because it's not really a Marvel movie. It's actually a Sony movie with a partnership with Marvel. And this is a distinction that has a very important difference, because the Marvel movies all have a pretty solid baseline of quality. They're pretty well made. This is not. Jared Leto stars as Dr. Michael Morbius. Morbius is better known as the living vampire from the Spider-Man comic book. He is a tertiary Spider-Man villain. He is a very minor character. He was introduced in the 1970s. They tried to give him his own series in the 1990s. It didn't work. Nobody was interested in him. I don't understand why this movie exists outside of Sony trying to build up a Spider-Man expanded universe. So anyway, Jared Leto plays this doctor who tries to cure his own blood disease by merging his DNA with vampire bat DNA. Shocker, terrible idea. Turns him into a vampire, except he doesn't really have any of the weaknesses of a vampire. He's not allergic to sunlight. He's not, allergic to garlic. He's not allergic to crosses. You know, what exactly his weaknesses are is unclear, but he's got lots of strength. And the cure that he gives himself, an amoral friend of his also takes, because he also has the disease, and makes him evil. So then you've got good vampire versus evil vampire, and blah, blah. It's just not very good. It's a very pain-by-numbers origin story. The special effects are bad. The storytelling, the actual storytelling is pretty bad. And the efforts in this film to build a Spider-Man expanded universe is done so remarkably poorly that I just don't know what they were going for.
So we have a dead end in the Marvelverse. It's a cul-de-sac.
I mean, they've had a lot of success with the Venom movies, right? Tom Hardy's Venom movies. And it's not impossible to do this sort of thing, but if you're going to do it, you have to do it like Marvel did, and everything has to be very well done, especially with some of these minor characters. You know,
can't do
like
it
the
on
first
the
Thor movie.
Yeah, or not do it on the first Thor movie. Ugh. All right, Sonny Bunch on Twitter at Sonny Bunch. Also across the movie aisle, and the bulwark goes to the movie. Make sure that you enjoy all of Sonny Bunch's podcasts, and of course, more airline miles for him, because that was a good segment. And Tarzana Joe is next. Don't go anywhere. You are listening to the Hugh Hewitt Show. I'm joined now by the poet laureate of the Hugh Hewitt Show, Tarzana Joe. Hello, Joe.
Hello, Hugh. What a challenge. How to summarize a week like this, eh?
No, it's hard.
We gave it a try. I know mankind is fallen, and we are in every way. But I have to ask the question, must we prove it every day? Our culture is collapsing. Listen, you can hear the heralds, and we're sinking into chaos like a fleet of Edmund Fitzgeralds. We can't keep looking sideways, because in no uncertain terms, it's not one that we're ignoring, but a room of pachyderms. Huh. We were told that with the Bidens, well, we all could take a breather. But alas, the best and brightest aren't really much of either. The Congress is immobile. I can't think what they've enacted. And everything our leader says has swiftly been retracted. Teachers are designing ways to compromise each student. And the teams we like to root for make decisions far from prudent. Maybe go and see a movie. No, the movies are too woke, and the people who produce them clearly cannot take a joke. So I shake my fist at heaven, and I shake my fist at hell. I don't know who to blame when things have not been going well. I'm shouting at the chaos, but I just can't reach my hearer. Guess it's time to make some changes. better look into the mirror. That's Time to Run for School Board, or Why I'm Reading Moby Dick by Tarzana Joe.
Joe, are you announcing a candidacy this morning?
No, but I'm urging those with children in school, and mine are far from there, my one, to do some serious thinking about that.
I think Tarzana Joe for board of Tarzana School Board would be a good thing.
Well, okay, I'll explore the possibility.
And I've never before thought that you could get Pachyderm and Edmund Fitzgerald into a single rhyme.
Thank you. I felt like it was the highlight of Tarzana Joeism to get those two in there.
And the least we can do is go out with some Gordon Lightfoot. I do appreciate it. I want everyone to know that they can get their own bit of verbal dexterity in rhyme for your appropriate occasion, whether it's a wedding or a farewell party or an anniversary, by writing to Joe, TarzanaJoe@Reagan.com, TarzanaJoe@Reagan.com. It's working. Or by visiting TarzanaJoe.com and finding the Get a Poem button. Is there a Get a Poem button? I don't know.
I want a poem.
I want a poem. So rates are reasonable, and it's inflation. Have you raised your rates 20% yet?
Nope. And I just gave a big discount to returning customers. So
there you go.
Very reasonable.
That's not smart in an inflationary era, but Tarzana Joe is a poet. So what do we expect?
Make it up on volume.
Keep rhyming. Keep rhyming. TarzanaJoe@Reagan.com. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Hugh.
Morning Glory, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live inside the Beltway. The Wall Street Journal editor is today writing, as Russia's war on Ukraine enters its sixth week, the script has flipped. Russia's advance has stalled, and Ukraine now wants to go on the offense to push back Russian forces from land they've taken, but the country needs U.S. and NATO help to do that. Also in the Telegraph this morning, word comes that the Russian forces have retreated from a Ukrainian airfield that was key to their original plan of overthrowing Zelensky. Hostomel Airport was the scene of some of the fiercest fighting in the Ukrainian war. 5 weeks on, the Russians have moved out, having failed. I'm joined by former Allied Supreme Commander James Stavridis. Good morning, Admiral. Great to have you on. You are ubiquitous, and I'm glad you actually know what you're talking about. Good morning. How are things in Florida?
Everything is great, although I am going to surprise you by being in New York City today.
Oh, my goodness.
So, a little closer. Hey, I wanted to add one thing to your excellent summary, which is just breaking on television right now. Some great footage of fuel depots aflame. Not in Ukraine, Hugh, but in Russia. Evidently, the Ukrainians have crossed the border into Russia. The reports, and we'll have to see the veracity of it all, but the initial reports are helicopter strikes flown very low, went in and blew up fuel tanks. There's certainly a big fire in Russia right now.
You know, Admiral, I've wondered from the beginning whether or not the Ukrainians had the capacity for a Doolittle raid, and if they did, whether it would be wise. What do you think about that?
I think they have the capacity, and I think it's wise in both counts. For those who are not familiar, General Jimmy Doolittle, after Pearl Harbor, mounted a long-range strike against the Japanese home islands, which surprised, shocked, and really caused the Japanese to doubt their capability. Let's hope Vladimir Putin takes the Doolittle lesson away from this attack.
So, Admiral, I don't know if your ears were burning on Tuesday. Tom Cotton was touting you to go into the White House as a strategic advisor on national security. So I don't know whether or not the senator succeeded in getting you called by Ron Klain to the president. But tell me what you think of the war right now and of our response. Just give us the overview, the Stavridis overview.
I'm glad to. I think diplomatically, things have gone better than expected. I think there's real unity in the West. And, of course, it's not just NATO. It's democracies around the world, including Japan, South Korea, Australia, our Pacific allies. So diplomatically, it's knit together very well. Economically, the sanctions are beginning to have real bite. The biggest thing, Hugh, is the fact that we've locked up two-thirds of the $600 billion that Putin had stored away as a war chest. $400 billion of that is locked inside Western institutions and is under embargo, sanction, and that will continue to confound him because, you know, war is hell. It's also expensive. And finally, militarily, the Ukrainians obviously have stood and delivered, defended their country, and are forcing Russia to shift from plan A, a blitzkrieg, to plan B, fall back to the Donbass and try and negotiate your way out of this. So from where we sat 6 weeks ago, I think it's a very strong effort across the board.
Admiral, the thing I read last night that was most interesting is every weapons manufacturer in the world is trying to get their platform used in Ukraine and on film so they can prove its effectiveness. Are there any larger lessons about how war has evolved, such as we learned in 1991 with the destruction of the Iraqi army in Kuwait, or in 2003 in the march to Baghdad? We learned a lot about combined arms. What have we learned here, if anything?
Point one would be, if you don't exercise combined arms, because the Russians are not, if you can't knit together distant fires, close fires, tactics on the ground, air, cyber, intelligence, maritime, if you can't knit that together, you're not going to be an effective fighting force on today's battlefield. Point two, I think if you're an armor enthusiast, you know, tanks and armored personnel carriers, you got to take a deep breath watching how these javelins and NLAWs and various anti-tank, anti-armor weapons have really chewed up the Russian forces. Part of that is, you know, see paragraph one, if they were exercising combined arms, they would have done better. I think it's premature to say that the tank is going to be the battleship of World War II, making way for something like an aircraft carrier. We're not quite at that point in the assessment, but certainly you have to question armor. And third and finally, the new strategic triad of the battlefield, Hugh, is going to be special forces, which is what the Ukrainians really resemble in a lot of ways, light, nimble, highly armed, highly connected. A second leg of that triad is going to be unmanned, the superb use of drones in particular. And the third leg of that triad is going to be command and control, cyber, the ability to knit it all together. Those are the premium tools of the trade that are, you're seeing the Ukrainians exercise well, and you're seeing the Russians exercise badly, and the results speak for themselves.
Admiral, what does the United States Navy take away from the fact that a drone attacked a ship in port and blew it up in the on the Russian? It was a tank cargo carrier, boat, big hull, but not very important to the conduct of war, other than getting stuff. But if it was sunk by a drone, what does the United States Navy do about that?
Well, first and foremost, we don't pull our ships into a port where we haven't fully understood what the lay of the land is around the port. Again, it goes back to combined arms. The Navy, the Russian Navy, is acting as though, man, we'll just pull the ship in wherever we want. We won't worry about what's happening on the ground. Maybe the Ukrainians don't have the kind of weapon that can reach out as occurred in this case. So, point one would be the combined arms piece of this. And then a second point the Navy will take away from this is the way that Putin has used the Black Sea Fleet as a kind of a blocking force to hold down Ukrainian troops. If that Black Sea Fleet didn't exist, Ukraine could move troops, even more troops, into the fight in the southeast. But they've got to hedge against the possibility of an amphibious assault. So that's a pretty good lesson. It harkens back, as you'll recall, to the Korean War and the Incheon landings. The Ukrainians have to hedge against it. Putin can use his Navy to kind of threaten that. It's a reasonably effective use of the Navy, but again, you got to be able to protect the ships when they do come in close to port.
Well, I was about to ask you about the Korean example of a successful Allied counterattack that goes too far and triggers the intervention of the Chinese. Do the Ukrainians have to, provided that the West gives them everything they need, do they have to stop at some place to avoid triggering a greater conflict?
Those will be decisions made as the fight unfolds. But if events are true to what we're seeing this morning, the Ukrainians have already decided that they're not going to stop at the borders of Russia. And by the way, the Russian response, at least as reported a few moments ago, was, this action, this attack inside Russia is not going to be helpful in the negotiations. I mean, you know, my reaction is, really? After Russia has spent 36 days pounding the hell out of every city in Ukraine, for them to say, oh, my God, you've struck a fuel depot inside Russia, and now we're going to pull back from negotiations as a result. I think that's disingenuous in the extreme, and I hope the Ukrainians continue to surprise and confound the Russians, not only on the main battle line, but jump behind that battle line and impose more cost on Russia.
Last question, Admiral. Do you want the West to continue to surge everything we've got, including things like the Switchblade drones, which are now suddenly we're aware of and we didn't know about before the war, and now we're aware of it, and the Turkish drone? Do you want us to throw everything we can short of troops that are wearing NATO uniforms?
100%. And there are several reasons we should do that, but the obvious one is the courage, the fighting spirit of these Ukrainians. Churchill, before World War II, said, give us the tools, we will finish the job, to the United States. And we ought to put every tool they ask for in their hands, to include, in my view, by the way, fighter aircraft, not flown by NATO pilots, flown by Ukrainians. Give them the tools, give them what they're asking for.
Okay, quick bonus question. There are Russian POWs. Ukrainians have been deported. I think it's incumbent on the Ukrainians to treat those Russian POWs like they were guests. What do you think?
100% correct. Maintain the moral high ground. And that's a well-trodden path in war. Long-term, if you're going to be a democracy, if you're going to adhere to rule of law, you're also going to take care of prisoners in the right way.
Amen to that. Admiral James Stavridis, have a great weekend in New York. Call me when you're in the Beltway. I'll buy you lunch. Always a pleasure to talk to him. Don't go anywhere, America. It's April Fool's Day. No April Fool's jokes here. Just the news on the Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. They're with Sierra Pacific. They lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I'm joined by Morgan Ortegas, former Mike Pompeo deputy at the State Department, where she's a spokesman for the United States. I wish she was there still during this crisis, but she's running for Congress in Tennessee, provided that the old boy network down there doesn't try and keep Morgan Ortegas from running. Good morning, Morgan. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Hugh. I'm great. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Don't fall for any April Fool's jokes today. Don't go down that way. Morgan, would you, first of all, give us the details on where people can find your campaign, to help your campaign, and to follow you on Twitter?
Well, thank you so much for asking. It's MorganOrtegas.com. My last name is a little tricky, so I'll spell it for you. It's O-R-T-A-G-U-S. So MorganOrtegas.com, and all of my social media handles are at MorganOrtegas.
Now, when you left the Trump administration, you moved to Tennessee. You and your family moved to Tennessee, and you're in the Nashville area, and you're running for Congress. And the Tennessee legislature is full of good old boys. And I like some. I like Senator Frank Nicely. He follows me on Twitter. We go back. But they didn't want you. They want one of their buddies. So they're trying to pass an unconstitutional law saying you've had to have been there for 3 years. What in the world, Morgan, are you doing about that? That's just as wildly unconstitutional as saying, you don't get to have benefits if you move to California and you're poor. That was knocked down years ago as a violation of the right to travel interstate.
Yeah, well, thank you for bringing it up, Hugh. I mean, listen, I have never been a political candidate before. I'm not a career politician. There's plenty of those in the field. So don't worry, if you like career politicians, you'll have a few that you can choose from. I have worked my entire life in national security. And, you know, every moment, Hugh, every election is about a certain moment. And I think right now, as we see a border that is just overrun, as if, you know, as if America were a failed state, and we see everything going on around the world where Biden and Kamala Harris have utterly failed, I thought, you know what, maybe this is a moment for me to run and to share my expertise. We moved to Tennessee. I helped start a business here, an investment fund. And had no thought, no clue even that there'd be a congressional seat open when I moved here. I think, like many people who have moved into Tennessee's 5th congressional district into Nashville, I call this political refugees. You know, people from other states are moving here because it's a beautiful, wonderful state to raise your children, to raise your family, and to get away from some of the stuff that you read about in the headlines in many blue states. I'm, of course, you know, spent the last 2 years in the Trump administration, so I was working for him. Would have moved to Tennessee even sooner, but I was fighting the good fight for President Trump and Mike Pompeo. So my argument has been the whole time, listen, just give people the choice. They can decide that I'm the right person for the moment, that I have the skills and the expertise to take on the Biden administration in a way that no one else can in this race. By the way, that's the same conclusion that President Trump came to. Or they could choose someone else, but give people the choice. Not, you know, let's let the voters decide.
Now, Morgan, which district are you running in?
It's the 5th congressional district.
And that's got a slice of Nashville, and then it moves a little bit south, right?
Yeah, we have 6 counties. So about half of the district is Williamson and Davidson. So Davidson's about half of Nashville, Williamson. You have a lot of Brentwood. People are, you know, familiar for that. And then you have 4 other counties, which are rural, you know, somewhat rural counties, which is very similar to actually where I grew up in Florida. I grew up in a bunch of, my farms, cattle, citrus groves, that sort of environment. But of course, Tennessee is just growing so rapidly that even those rural counties are experiencing great growth.
Now, the great thing about this is it would bring from Tennessee a person who would instantly be, I think, on the Foreign Affairs Committee and in the tradition of Bill Hagerty and other great Tennesseans going back many, many, many generations who know their way around the world. I just can't believe Frank and the other old boys in the Tennessee legislature think they can pass an unconstitutional law excluding everyone from the ballot. It's not in the Constitution. You have to be 25 and a resident of the state in which you're running. You are more than 25. I hate to really reveal your audience to the audience, your age, but you're older than 25 and you live in Tennessee. That's it. You're qualified. Are you intervening in the lawsuit? Oh, of course, Governor Lee hasn't signed it yet. So I guess there is no lawsuit.
That's right. Yeah. Governor Lee has not signed it yet. I've read the report similar to you that an outside super PAC that is supportive of me will be filing suit along with, representing people in Tennessee, voters in Tennessee. And that is led by Charlie Spees, who I think is one of the best lawyers in the country. I'm certainly lucky to have him on my side. So we'll see what happens. The Wall Street Journal has written about it. I think I've gotten a lot of calls over the past few days of people that are really sympathetic to how they perceive that I'm being treated, which is nice, which is lovely. My argument is, I've always tried to be really respectful of local issues and the ability of the state legislature to decide local issues. And so, you know, I've tried to remain positivity and grace and dignity throughout it. And I'm hopeful that all of this will be resolved in the way that's right, in the way that's conservative, right? In the way that we all as Republicans and conservatives believe that the voters will be able to choose who's the best conservative and best representative for them in the race. I think they're going to come to the same conclusion that Donald Trump did, and that's me.
I believe that Republicans across the United States stand for one thing, no matter where they are on the spectrum, defend the Constitution. Separation of powers, federalism, and the Constitution does not allow the Tennessee legislature to handpick candidates by excluding new immigrants. Now, let's talk a little bit. We'll have time to talk about Tennessee issues as we get closer. When is the primary, by the way, Morgan?
August 4th. So we've got a little bit of time.
We got time. But I want to talk to you about Ukraine right now. I don't know if you went to Russia with Mike Pompeo. I don't know if you've ever. Have you been in a room with Putin?
I've been to Russia. I've been in a room with him and Putin, who is just an evil, evil man. The hair on my skin stood up, I think, when he walked into the room. Also been to Ukraine. We were there almost exactly 2 years ago in Kyiv with President Zelensky.
So nobody intimidates Mike Pompeo. Nobody intimidates Morgan Ortega.
Nope.
What do you think is going on or going to happen in Ukraine now? Will the Russians blink and stand down?
I would say that they're down, but not out. I will tell you what I am concerned about is I think it's too premature to use the word stalemate, but you're obviously seeing, we're all reading the reports. I'm reading the same stuff you are about the Ukrainians fighting back. I mean, that's the one thing that I've said this entire time in this David and Goliath fight is you know, growing up, my father always told me when we were watching sports together, my poor dad didn't have any boys. So, you know, he had to teach, had to watch sports with all his girls. But my dad always told me, always root for the underdog, because the underdog has heart. The underdog wants to fight. The underdog wants to win. And so I think the whole world has just seen, you know, Ukraine being in that situation. And for all the hard power, all of the assets, all of the troop numbers that Russia has, you know, you just can't quantify whenever you're looking at an analysis. You just can't quantify when somebody has the heart and the will to fight and defend their country. And I think that's what's been beautiful about Ukraine. You know, the troubling thing for me is over the past year, we as in the Biden administration, we've not been able to deliver the knockout punch to the Russians. And we have the ability to do so, right? So it's a continuum of half measures. It's a continuum of things that look and sound, you know, really tough, but aren't actually, you know, tough. And so what I mean by that is we make a big show of coming out weeks ago and saying things like, we will no longer buy Russian, you know, oil and gas. Okay, that's fantastic. But if you don't put secondary sanctions on the oil industry or on the gas industry, on the energy industry in Russia, well, then India, China, other people are just going to come in and prop it up. You know, so when you look at all of the sanctions, it's like sanction a few banks, but not the central bank, not all the banks. Go for a few oligarchs, right? So it's a series of measures, which, by the way, are important. I'm not against them. But it is not, for example, the maximum economic pressure campaign that we did against the Islamic Republic of Iran, where Mike Pompeo looked at them and said, you know what, I'm taking all of your oil off the market. There's a very big difference in terms of strategy. Does that make sense?
I'm talking with Morgan Ortega. She is running for Congress in Tennessee. MorganOrtegas.com.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.